Hello, this is Bookish, a new podcast in which I talk to some writers. I am Richard Hurst, your host, your Grand Inquisitor. Maybe you know me as Vivmondo, or at Vivmondo, or I thought I told you to wait in the car.com, or maybe you don't know me at all, which is fine. In any case, good morning, slash afternoon, slash evening. Hopefully you'll hear me having some interesting conversations with some indubitably interesting writers. I think I'd say for optimal audio pleasure, you should be listening to this whilst trapped in a very early morning commute or during a bout of insomnia. Essentially, so long as you're tired. My ideal listener is a very, very tired person with very, very impaired judgment. A person on the brink of sleep. So if you're feeling a bit awake right now, that's okay, that's fine, that's nothing to worry about, but if you are planning on listening to any future episodes after this, then you'll need to do some work and become very, very sleepy. So aside from hermit, or astronaut potentially, writing is famously the loneliest profession in the entire world. Yet writing is also public, involves communicating with an audience, but at the same time the only interviews of any great length you get to hear are with actors or musicians or footballers. Did Parkinson ever have John Berryman or William Burroughs in his show? No, he didn't. He just made a drunken Oliver Reed cavort for his own malign amusement, or pretended he was being pecked by a clearly fraudulent emu. Occasionally you will see an interview with Martin Amis, but that's only because whoever's talking to him is hoping he'll say something controversial about Muslims. So first of all, I travelled to Preston, the home, as I'm sure you're all aware, of Britain's first ever branch of KFC, or Kentucky Fried Chicken, as I'm informed it was then known. It was also, for about 10 years, the home of me, your humble, silken-throated, annoying host, and the home, too, of Jen Ashworth. Jen's first book, A Kind of Intimacy, came out in 2007, I think. It was a tense, yet dark, yet funny story about Annie, an overweight, mentally unbalanced woman, recounting some very unreliable memories, and it got huge praise, and was followed by her second novel, Cold Light, which has just come out in paperback. Cold Light is about shared blood secrets of teenage girls in Preston during the 1990s, and has been a big success. If you're not read either of those, I strongly urge you to read both. You may have also read an article she recently wrote for The Guardian about her horrific schooling experiences, and she just finished her third book, a story set in yet another pokey northern town, this time Chorley, which is the birthplace of me, interestingly, and home to the world's largest community of Mormons outside of America. Jen was brought up a Mormon, her new book is about Mormons, and not surprisingly, you'll hear us talking about Mormons. In addition to being a successful, and in my genuine and humble opinion, one of the best young writers around at the moment, Jen is also one of my best friends. Isn't that sweet? We knew each other when we were kids, we were housemates for a while, so it was actually quite interesting to hear her talk about books and how she feels about writing, rather than whose turn it is to do the washing up, or where the remote's gone, or whether we should do something about the weird ginger kid across the road who used to spy on us.
Drinking anymore. Just giving it up for to your birthday.
Shut up. Do you want half?
Yeah, go on then.
I'm
not giving up drinking.
You know you're not drinking your own, are you?
Your house. You're a guest. It's kind of weird to do one of these ones because I know you.
I know, so you'll know if I'm lying.
How long have we known each other? It's been about 15 years.
Since 1998.
So 14 years.
14.
And it's weird that you write about, in this last book at least, in Cold Light, you write about teenagers because we were teenagers then. It's mm-hmm. kind of odd that I think I recognise things,
mm-hmm.
but I'm never sure if they're an invention that I just recognise because they're kind of the things that you get in descriptions of teenagers' lives, or if it's actually, you know, if I'm sort of there somewhere, or the sort of the world I come through from there.
I think that the school that the girls go to is very loosely set on the school that I went to, which was before we met each other. And the characters are all made up, but what I know about being a teenage girl is through being one. So probably there are bits of me that you might recognise in some of it, even though it's not an autobiographical story. But I think a lot of what people say about teenagers and teenage girls especially, that, you know, they have older boyfriends and they shoplift and they try on makeup and get drunk in parks, those things are all in the book because I wanted it to be familiar in that way, and for it to be, people say that it, being a teenager is a time of wildness, but it seems that there's very well trodden paths of what it is you're supposed to do to be wild, and they act it all out in very unwild ways.
I remember a while ago you saying something to me that was the reason that like people are our age and people are in the past before us, a thing that helped them become writers was that you were bored for a lot of the time as well. It was the, you know, teenage life was really boring. There was like there wasn't much to do for most of the time, other than contemplate yourself and, you know,
read and be depressed.
Yeah, and it's hard to know, but it doesn't really seem the case like that now. It seems like there's lots of opportunities to always be entertained or distracted.
I remember being on my own a lot as a teenager. I didn't go to school, which admittedly was unusual, but I think even out of school, a lot of teenagers now are very plugged into their social lives through their computers or not, and perhaps are a lot more independent than we were or was common for us or than I was allowed to be. So I was very definitely on my own and reading a lot. Or we didn't have the internet until, or we never had it at home while I lived there. I don't think the first time I went on the internet I was 17.
I think so. You were in my house, I think.
I was. It was the Pepper Army website. It was.
Oh, wow. I don't remember that. I remember you being really amazed by the internet at my house.
I remember being not quite understanding why you'd go on a website and you saying, "Will you just find stuff out? Look, there's even one on that Pepper Army you're eating." That must have been before you were a vegetarian.
Well, I don't know. Was I a Pepper Army? Or were you eating it?
Probably I was eating it. But yeah, there was. Yeah, so there just wasn't anything. I went to your house occasionally. But yeah, definitely being on my own and reading. And I wrote a lot. I think university was very different in that respect, being an older teenager, because I was sociable in that way and was working really hard and wasn't bored and I didn't write very much. So yeah, I think it was very formative. And being in Preston as well, which is in the book a little bit, Lala talks about, you know, everything being a train ride away in Manchester, and when you are 14, a tenner for a train ride is very out of reach sometimes. Yeah. So there was not that freedom at all.
Do you think if you'd set it, because it's set in the 90s, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you think if you tried to set it now, it would work, or it would be a different, well, it would be a different book? Do you think it would?
I think it would be a really different book. It starts in Boxing Day 1997, and goes to Valentine's Day 1998, and then is retold and remembered kind of now. She's looking back on it now, so she's the same age as we are. But she has a mobile phone and Chloe has a mobile phone, and they're quite special for having mobile phones because Cole works in Currys, I think it is. He works in some electronic shop. That was the excuse for them having it, because it was just the mobile phones weren't particularly new, but they weren't something that 14-year-olds had.
You would have been
unusual. And I think just the fact that these girls were able to contact each other in private with that mobile phone, and that Carl could get hold of them in private, and that be quite unusual, was sinister in this book, in a way that it's just not now at all. It's very normal. And I think the language as well, I think I was able to capture how teenage girls and northern teenage girls spoke to each other at that time, because I could remember it. But now it would be completely different.
Well, yeah, and it's kind of strange that all the people who were people who were teenagers then, they still kind of talk that way.
Yeah.
Like all our people, our age groups, they still talk in a similar kind of more grown up version of the way we spoke, which is really strange. It makes you wonder what it would be like in the future when people who, you know, young people who we might have trouble understanding what they mean a lot of the time, but they'll kind of adapt it into a grown up language, and then there'll be like another load of teenagers saying more incomprehensible things.
I think YA authors must spend quite a lot of time eavesdropping and on school buses and in parks and things, because it is completely different. And I think I remember being quite aware of it as a teenager, and about the kind of words and slang and sentence constructions that we used. It was about excluding other people, wasn't it? Excluding
kids and grown-ups. Having your own kind of language in a way.
Yeah, like the sort of music you listen to and the clothes that you wore.
I read someone on Twitter today saying the word "klebs," so clever.
I like that.
I kind of, it's all right, but it's one syllable less. It doesn't really save you any time.
Yeah, that's like www, isn't it?
That's true, yeah. When you said about people eavesdropping on teenage, did you do any sort of hang around with teenagers? Did you try and listen in to like how the dynamics work, or was it still fresh in your mind enough for you to revisit?
No, I didn't. I didn't research current teenagers at all, because I felt that, you know, I didn't want to date the book so much so that only people who were my age or a few years either side would find it appealing and would be able to understand it. But I did want it to be kind of not a museum piece, but I wanted it to feel really like 1997. And I just felt that because the language and the fashion and music and everything, the culture changes so quickly, that it wouldn't be really useful to me. But what I did do was look at my diaries, because just really miserable. I kept a diary from when I was 13 almost every day up until I was about last year, maybe, so 28. Really? Yeah, so I looked at my diary entries for 96, 97, 98. 99, you were in some of them.
how was that though, reading?
It was straight, like my handwriting is the same. My spelling has not improved. And I can see some of the things that I was writing about are still things that I'm interested in now, so I can kind of recognise that person, but not really. And that's that sense of, I suppose, I was 14, 15, and a lot of the things that were happening to me had never happened to me before. You know, everything you forget, like everything's just so completely new.
That's true,
like the first time I went on a train somewhere on my own, and all these kind of really small things. And I think it's just the weird way that diaries work, because there are things that happened during that period that I remember really vividly as being quite important and quite changing, kind of turning points in my development. But at the time, I must not have thought they were important, because I haven't written them down.
Really?
Yeah, and the things that I thought were important and significant and spent loads and loads of time writing about are the people that I thought were really significant. I look back now and think, oh no. There's one entry that I've written down how much things cost, because I kind of got the sense that if I looked back as an adult, I would want to know.
What was it? What?
It was like a can of Coke, 29p.
Really?
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
I know. It's weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I think because I was brought up in a religion where writing a diary was a good thing. This was something you were instructed to do.
Really?
Yeah, definitely. Like, you know, Mormons are very often, I wouldn't say all of them, but good Mormons keep journals. They
That's
do.
Interesting, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. I think it's really interesting. And it's not a kind of a moral activity. The reason why you do it is to keep a record of the way that God has acted in your life.
Is it supposed to be a diary that sort of documents your faith? Or is it committed to just
I don't think it's ever as prescriptive as that, but certainly what you are supposed to record is your kind of, I don't know, your personal thoughts and feelings and your family and your spiritual development. And it's a way of almost creating evidence for the church so that you can show these journals to your children and they can read them when you're dead and see how God acted in your life and see how, I don't know, when you were obedient you were blessed and various things. So there's a very certain set of things that is good for you to record. And I think possibly even when I started writing the book, I was quite a bad Mormon because there's really nothing like that. I used to call it the grudge book, and it's kind of just a big list of complaints.
it's weird that Mormonism, more than other religions it seems, is concerned with their future generations or the past. Like, they baptise dead people, that other religions don't really. No. They pray or whatever, maybe. But
about family, because Mormons, and I think I'm right in saying they are fairly unique amongst Christian religions for believing that before we were born, we existed. In a spirit form, and came to Earth in order to get bodies and to find a family. And that after you die, if you've been faithful and kept your covenants, that you stay in your family. And so family and kind of spending your time on Earth, cementing these links with people and your posterity is very, very important to Mormons. And they say, you know, families are forever, which is also horrifying for some.
Does that sort of stuff come up in the new thing you've written, that you want to talk about in the new book?
Yeah. So the new book is called The Friday Gospels, and it's about a Mormon family.
Mm.
And like my first two books, it's set in the Northwest, it's set in Chorley, which is very kind of culturally and historically important to UK Mormons.
Mm.
It's one of the first places that the missionaries from Utah landed. So
it's probably really odd for people who don't live in Chorley to imagine this little, quite small town in the Northwest that has a huge Mormon population and dominated by
Mini Utah.
This massive temple, which is just kind of all these little suburban houses and shops and a hospital and stuff, and then you get to this ring road and there's a huge temple with a golden angel on top of it.
Moroni and his trumpet.
Is that who he is?
That's who he is. It is an unusual thing, and because Chorley is such a little place, and otherwise Chorley is, I would say, absolutely typical of a Northwest market town, apart from how significant it is to Mormon history and culture. Mm. I think some of the first baptisms that took place in the UK took place in the River Ribble.
Really?
Yeah, whoa, yeah. Whoa. I know. So,
disgusting sounding baptism to have.
But I think because my interest has always been in the Northwest, so our kind of intimacy was set in Fleetwood and Cold Light in a kind of weird version of Preston, but not quite Preston. So I think even if I hadn't have had contact with the Mormon community personally, I still think I probably would have ended up writing about it, because I just think it's a really underlooked at bit of Lancashire life and heritage. I think culturally it was an extremely shaping experience, and even this idea of journal keeping. I remember reading my journals when I was 14 or 15 and seeing everything that I'd written and becoming very curious about the way you wrote and used the word I, and yet it somehow escaped from you and ended up being a very unreliable way of writing. Which is why I'm sure all the novels that I've written have been fictional versions of autobiography.
Yeah.
And so with the Friday Gospels, it's not one first person narrator, it's five.
Mm.
And each of these five narrators is a member of the one family. And so this idea of the family being a kind of unit that every single person is required to play their part so that they all get to heaven. And I kind of wanted to reflect this idea in the book. So no one of these characters really understands the full story except the reader who reads, you know, all of the different bits of the book, but all the family, you know, each of these narratives is essential to understanding it. So that's what I was trying to do there.
Do you think, like, you don't consider yourself Mormon anymore? Did you, like, you officially sort of divided yourself from them, didn't you?
I did. I mean, it's a really big and interesting question, which I'll probably bore you about, but the kind of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, as they prefer to be called, they don't encourage their members to refer to themselves as Mormons or the Mormon Church. They don't really like that. And I think it's because they want very much to distinguish themselves from, say, polygamous groups or groups who are practicing a kind of United Order, law of consecration, sort of mini communism. So very fundamentalist groups. They want to make sure that they're very different from those in people's minds. And also people like me who don't have a faith or a religious affiliation to them, but, you know, I don't know, I could call myself a cultural Mormon, and that would make sense to me.
Yeah.
That there are,
like,
people
being
who are
Jewish.
Exactly.
Like being
exactly,
being
Catholic. Yeah, definitely. And I think because if you're in it, it's such a consuming religion. It is something that you never wash out of your hair, ever. But no, I kind of sent a letter and resigned my membership, so they wouldn't, certainly they would not consider me to be a member or a Mormon anymore. And it was quite important for me to do that because there's a lot about the religion that is interesting, and a lot of the values I think are very good, but a lot about it I would be ashamed to be associated with.
Really? Like what?
They put a lot of money into funding campaigns to make sure that Proposition 8 in California, you know, about gay marriage, to get mixed up in a lot of politics that way. Generally, their views on homosexuality are fairly medieval, in my opinion. And I wouldn't say it's a good religion to be a woman in either.
Do you know if you had any kind of feedback from practicing Mormons about, you know, your work or anything?
No. I imagine with the Friday Gospels that there will be a mixed response. It's not a book that sets out to damage or ridicule or even particularly criticise people's attempts to have a spiritual element to their life or a relationship with God. I find that tendency in humans to be very, I don't know, it's something I approve of, even if I don't share it. But certainly it's fairly critical over some aspects of what I consider to be quite a restrictive culture, especially for young women. I can imagine some are not going to like it, and I can imagine some are going to find it funny, and there are jokes in that book that only Mormons are going to get. And, you know, Mormons certainly are not blind to the humour in their own culture. I think part of being a writer is putting books out and people reading them and being able to have an opinion. And, you know, there are some readers, whether they're Mormon or not, that are not going to like what I do, and that's all right.
I don't know if it's deliberately done, but the impression seems to be that there's a lot of, I don't know what you call them, rituals or things that Mormons do that they tend to prefer to keep secret.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's true or if that's...
There are ceremonies that go on in the temple that Mormons prefer not to speak about outside the temple because they consider it to be sacred. And if you don't go into the temple... and not all Mormons go into the temple. You have to kind of pass an interview and be judged worthy. So definitely. So it's not something that everybody does. So you wouldn't even know about it necessarily, or know about it in any great detail. Although having said that, you can't keep anything secret on after the internet and Google. So it's something that I touch on very, very briefly in my book, but I don't describe it because it feels like someone else's sacred ground. And it didn't feel necessary either. But you know, you can Google it and you can watch films and you can, you know, this is information that's already in the public domain. So I felt fairly comfy about alluding in, you know, to a degree of detail, but it wasn't really a very important part of the book.
I guess a lot of it is when people write about closed communities that exist and have their rituals and their things that they do. If they try and investigate them to document them, they find that a lot of it is too literally incredible. And if you actually wrote it down, it would...
There are aspects of, you know, it's not an autobiographical book, but there are certain scenes and events that I can remember from my life that I would like to have put into the novel and didn't feel like I could make them believable. But I think that's one of the weirdnesses about fiction, that often if you wrote down exactly what happened to you, it wouldn't work.
You wouldn't read.
No. But it's never been my intention to write a kind of document or a documentary or a... to like expose a closed culture, because there are a lot of books and films and kind of criticism and websites and all sorts about Mormonism, and people can find out whatever they want. And I was more interested in exploring one day in the life of this very particular family. So there's no way that anyone could say, including me, especially me, that my book was representative of British Mormons, because it's just not. It's about this one family.
As a character thing.
And I think it's one of the reasons why I chose to write a circadian novel. That, you know, novels that are set on one day, they either have to be the day that everything changes, the day that, you know, something explodes or collapses, or an everyday, a kind of slice of life. And I tried to do both with this book. So for most of the day, the characters are all anticipating the son coming home from his mission. And that is something that's very normal, a kind of normal rite of passage for a Mormon family. And it's a happy day. And what actually happens, because it's one of my books, is kind of a bit more bloody and disappointing.
Yeah, a bit more, the word would be, I guess like all... the things you write tend to kind of have a kind of shocking, revelatory climax sort of tone. That sort
but
of
I, because I think if people read one of, you know, if people read this book and they have read my previous two, they're kind of going to be expecting it, aren't they? And they're going to know in the first chapter when they all go, oh gosh, we're really looking forward to Gary coming home. The reader's like, going to know something
like,
bad's going to happen.
The Sixth Sense guy.
Yeah.
Like, every film has got like, a twist, and that's all anybody wants for.
Yeah.
And he made one that didn't have a twist, and everyone like really hated it. Even though they all hate him anyway, because they're like, oh, it's always a twist. And then everyone's like, comes along, it's like, where's the twist?
I think it's all right, you know, because I think it's recognisably one of my books in that it's dark and it's quite funny, and you know, it's all about quite flawed but likable human beings who are lying to themselves and each other, like we all do. And I think it would be a shame if people attached too much to the Mormonism, because I could have made up a religion, or I could have chosen a different religion, and I just chose this one because I know a lot about it and because it connects so well with Chorley and my interests in the Northwest. But yeah, still one of my books. Still fit nicely alongside Cold Light and A Kind of Intimacy.
Do you kind of think of yourself as a northern writer?
I suppose I must be, because it's
where that's I... a no, I think.
Well, I don't...
I don't mean like living here. I mean...
Yeah, because I live here.
I know.
So I must be, mustn't I? I don't know what it means. My books are set in the north. It's like women's fiction, isn't it? It just means absolutely nothing.
It's kind of weird for me to separate the person I know from the things that I read, like reviews of you or interviews of you.
A tissue of lies of my online persona.
You get painted as like a northern writer.
And I think that's strange because, well, maybe I'm wrong. I was going to say, because you don't get southern writers, do you? But you do, and you get, I don't know, Tyndall Street Press has made a virtue of publishing from kind of Birmingham and the Midlands and have done really great work there, and there are a lot of regional publishers and regional literary activity, so I'm not ashamed. It kind of pisses me off when people say I'm a Manchester writer, because Can I say the F word? No. But it's lazy, isn't it? It's like really badly researched guff. Your for this interview was just to drive me to rage.
Just to poke you with the things I know will annoy you.
It doesn't bother me if people say I'm a Northern writer because it is a fact. I just think it's a fairly uninteresting fact.
But do you think, like, the idea of a Northern writer, the idea that goes with that is kind of very domestic, kind of plodding, kind of, you know...
Maybe that's
advert sort of novelisation sort of thing. I don't know if you're kind
of... I think women get, you know, being a woman writer is probably more... You know, it has more of those kind of connotations attached to it. And again, you know, women's writing, what does that mean? Nothing. I think I would like my books to be absolutely incomparable to anything other than themselves, but then every single writer would say that, wouldn't they?
Yeah, that's true.
I think I'm influenced, certainly. So I did my MA in Manchester, and you know, it's not a sausage factory, and it's not a my books aren't cookie cutter novels, but I have always been aware of writing in a community that has kind of Manchester and Lancaster and Preston as quite important places in it. But I don't know, I can't say I'd be writing about Fleetwood if I hadn't have been born in Preston, so maybe it's just more about me than anything else. This is a bad answer, isn't it?
Not really. It's kind of true that you're not, I don't think you consciously, I might be wrong, but I don't think you consciously try to write about the North as a sort of proud, you know, chronicler.
No, if I came from Cornwall, that's what I'd be writing about. I'm interested. I think it's more about looking inwards, and I just feel I have been very shaped by where I've come from and an awareness of it.
Mm.
And I write about characters who share that.
Well, I think, yeah, when people talk about Northern writers, it tends to be like a bit of like a derogatory sort of thing to sort of imply that it's kind of simple, homely, you know, homespun tales and stuff.
I found it really difficult to assess my fiction and put it into a category or compare it to other people's, and I think it's possibly because I'm too close to it. I don't chafe against being labelled domestic, because I think all of our horror and worst behaviour happens when we're
I never really know what it means, domestic, because I don't think I've ever read a book that doesn't have somebody in a house at some point.
Exactly, and their family, I don't know, Shakespeare is quite domestic, isn't he?
Mm.
So people killing people they're related to.
Comparing yourself to Shakespeare.
No, just I think it's something that gets put onto women, doesn't it?
Mm.
So, I don't know, Joan Updike and Philip Roth and Jonathan Franzen can write about family and people inside their houses having trouble with their mothers, and it isn't domestic, it's literature.
Yeah, true. The thing you get with like Northern writers that when you'll have like a Northern writer who'll write the exact sort of thing that people imagine Northern writers do.
Yeah.
And you kind of think, oh, you're not doing us any favours, you're not doing anybody any favours.
I don't know if I do that or not.
Because that's in you, just me.
No,
yeah.
I don't know.
It's more like regional, sort of local type people who end up doing that.
But then America does regional literature really well, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, it does rural kind of.
Yeah.
You know, that's really the heart of what American
and it
literature is.
Absolutely respectable to write from the place you come from. I just don't think about it very much, I just write what I like.
The traditional thing is a teenager will write lots of short stories, and then you'll sort of get older and, you know, still be writing short stories, and eventually, like, write a novel. But you seem to be always writing novels.
I knew you were going to mention that book.
I'm not mentioning Paper Swallows. But
you know this.
I don't need to talk about your
great, your unpublished works.
Surely wonderful teenage book. I think I have still got a copy of somewhere.
Oh, no.
But it's... I remember you wanting to be a short story writer, or even writing short stories, I don't think, particularly. I know you have done, but
I definitely see myself as a novelist, but it's because of how big it is, and it's because I absolutely love reading huge novels, really. Yeah, there's a lot of novellas and short stories and slim literary volumes that are fantastic, but I like really big.
Mm.
I think... maybe because it's when I was a teenager, I read so fast. You know, I love this idea of living inside somebody else's world for quite a long time. And the size of a novel, when I started to write and I realised how long it took to write a sentence that wasn't shameful, the idea of writing a novel just seemed so impossible. It was like the universe throwing down a challenge.
Did you ever have a point where you kind of realised that you were, that it was actually something you could do? Or did you always think it was and you kind of just got better?
I always knew I was going to do it, whether I would get better, you know, I hoped I would get better at it. And I think each of my novels has been better than the last in some way. So I think I'm improving. But if I had not have been published with my first or second or third novel, I would still do it. Absolutely. And I can't, you know, I know writers who have written 7 novels and their 8th has been published and been successful. And I know writers who've written their whole lives and publications not very important to them. And I would have always tried to get published, but if it hadn't have happened, I don't think I'd have stopped at any point. It's very often for me an evening and nighttime thing, but that's when I'm being a writer, and it's every night between 8 o'clock and midnight, that's what I'm doing, and that's when I'm being a writer. And the other things that happen, like getting published and people reading it and interviews and things, it's nice, and you know, I'm very grateful, but it's like a tiny, tiny bit of why it is you do it and what it feels like to do it. And what it feels like is just sitting on your own typing. And that cannot, you know, and that's the bit that's appealing. I'm just not selling it at all.
Not really.
It is, it's lovely. And if I can't write, I can just, I don't know, I write in my journal or write letters to people, or it's just that way of thinking with a pen in your hand or on the keyboard. That's what I do.
It doesn't always feel rewarding, but it, you know, when it goes well, it feels like very rewarding. Yeah. And if it doesn't go well, it feels like the loneliest feeling in the world.
But I do it anyway.
Yeah, like, exactly.
It's not gone well for months at a time, and I still, not always, but I try to kind of have a discipline about it. And to,
do you ever worry that you'll like snap one day and suddenly be like really bad at it? It seems to happen, like, with, you know, if you're a very successful professional writer, it can quite easily, as you sort of hit your sort of mid-40s, you sort of seem to lose interest or impetus.
I wonder if it's like that, because if you are early career or you haven't yet been published, the shit that you write doesn't get published. It doesn't mean you don't write it, it just means it doesn't find its way out into the world. Whereas if you've already got a very famous name for yourself, then perhaps it's a commercial decision on the part of your publisher. People are going to buy it no matter what.
Yeah, maybe. Well, that's what I think. It's probably a bit of both, really. Yeah. It's probably your editors and your publishers are just, they're probably less critical than they would be, because A, it doesn't really matter that much, and B, you know, it's more intimidating to try and tell a professional, successful writer that something they've done isn't very good.
I'd always hope to be told or to be able to tell myself, but not publishing or not.
Well, it must be horrible to like spend, you know, so much time writing a novel and then sort of eventually maybe realise that it's not very good.
It's a real commitment. It is a huge commitment of time, and it is, you know, when I start, it can make me quite anxious, quite depressed to start like writing the first 2,000 words and realise that this is what I'm going to be doing for the next 3 years.
Have you ever got that far and changed your mind?
I've got a 30,000 word chunk of a novel that didn't work.
Really?
And I've got, there's the one that got nicked, the Bloom book. Yeah.
How much of that did you write?
90,000 words.
Christ, really?
It was bad. I don't know how I'd managed to write 90,000 words with no main character or storyline. And the only real thing I could tell you about it was that she sat in a garden shed and...
Yeah, I remember it. Was that the one with the...
Hot air balloon?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Did you know she weed?
Did she?
Yeah.
What, in the toilet? Not really surprising, as you seem to think it might be.
Probably that was took up quite just too many of the 90,000 words. Yeah, and then it was on... I had backed it up on a CD, but the CD was in the laptop and the laptop got stolen and it all went.
I wonder where that ended up.
Hopefully.
It might come out one day, published by some criminal who's gone straight.
I highly doubt it.
No one will care. They'll be like, oh, it's, you know, he's reformed, so it's
quite
good.
It was a really, really bad book, but it taught me, or I learned while I was doing it, discipline, because I had no idea how to make it better, and I just turned up every day and hammered away at it and added another 1,000 words or so. Mm. And if it hadn't been stolen, I probably would have been persevering with it even now. So it was, I think it was a good thing, because then it got stolen and I went to bed for a couple of days, and then I started writing a short story that turned into, accidentally, a kind of intimacy.
Yeah, I remember the
a tea party.
The early drafts of it being very weird and very completely different from what the book that is now known and loved has been.
It was, yeah.
It was a blackbird who narrated it, I seem to remember.
I think maybe I just learned things really, really slowly. But I'd read loads of books and studied books, and I thought I knew how they worked, and I knew what I wanted for a kind of intimacy was a narrator that could tell us things that Annie wouldn't ever tell us herself, because there were things that were bad or embarrassing about herself. But that I didn't want it to be a kind of third person intrusive, like quite old fashioned narrator, because it just felt too old fashioned and too much of a kind of controlling presence. So I thought, oh, well, it'll be like a blackbird that just watches everything she does.
Psychic blackbirdy.
And that
can relate things to the
an
reader.
Entire draft of the book, because and then once I realised there was already a way of doing this, and it was called The Unreliable Narrator, and the person who would fill in the gaps wouldn't be a blackbird, it would be the reader. And once I figured that out, then I was aware.
Well, that's like, I mean, obviously there's a lot more artistry involved in creating something that's through suggestion and hinting. And
but you think I would have figured out that's what I wanted to do?
Well, no,
without having to.
That's
like, seven drafts.
That's like, well, that's like all writers, though. It's like the thing that nobody tells you when you're at university or when you're doing anything, or when you're like a teenager, is everything you write from now on until quite a long time in the future will be very bad, and no one will ever want to read it. You'll be convinced it's brilliant, but it isn't, and it won't be, and no one will care.
And it's still worth doing.
Yeah, exactly. It's still, you have to do it if you want to actually get to the good thing. But I mean, they probably shouldn't tell you that, because it's very disheartening to be told everything.
Well, I teach, and it's a difficult thing, because I don't want to say, I just keep away from the whole publishing side of things, especially with the undergraduates, because some of them, you know, they really do want to make a career for themselves in writing, and it's a difficult and a rickety career. But I just want to talk about how this paragraph in particular is working and whether it's better than last time, because I just, when I write, that's what I do, and I kind of think reviews and sales and all that, the rest of it is just none of my business at all, and the only bit that's my business is the sentences. And that's the only bit I can control, so I just think about that. And when I'm speaking to my students, I don't want to say something like, this is publishable, because I'm not a publisher, and why should they strive to write something that's publishable? Why shouldn't they just strive to write this story as well?
Well, it's hard to know what is publishable anyway, because there's so much, there's quite a lot of bad things that get published that, you know, aren't particularly good. And then there's loads of things that are very good that, you know, you hear about them because they take a long time to get published. So I imagine there's lots of things that you won't hear about because they never get published.
And there's absolutely fantastically great pieces of writing that are published on a very small scale and sadly sink without trace quite a lot of the time. I just think the career side of things is really lovely for a writer when it goes well, but it's not always an indication of how good the work is.
You use unreliable narrators, as you said, and your characters are kind of on the fringes of sanity a lot of the time.
No, they're not.
They really are.
No, they're not.
Do you ever worry that if you died today that people would judge you on the characters, or do you think?
I tend not to think about dying too much, being not on the fringes of insanity. No, I don't think so. I think that, I don't know, readers do tend to do it. Like, I've gone to visit book groups and they've not met me, and they've read A Kind of Intimacy. And I walk in the room and they say, gosh, we didn't expect you to look like this, which they think I'm going to be like Annie, like big. And they ask me about Lola and ask me, I don't know, yeah, people are sometimes a bit.
I think if I didn't know you about it and I'd read the books and then I was going to meet the person who'd written them, I'd think I'd expect them to be slightly like unbalanced, I think, in some way.
But I'm fully cheery and
balanced. I know, that's the thing. In a sense, that's like the art of them, is being able to sort of create characters.
I'd make it up. Ruth Rendell said, I think, no, it wasn't, I'm lying, edit that bit out. P.D. James said that she wrote about it so she didn't have to do it. Paraphrasing madly.
Is that how you think of?
I think there are bits like, you know, everyone's got a shadow, haven't they? And I use what I imagine the bits, and I don't know, it can't be my shadow that I'm writing about because you don't see your own shadow, that's the point. But this idea that there's a whole half of yourself or your personality that is unknown to you and maybe pretty obvious to everybody else, I find very unsettling and unnerving. And it's something that I've, you know, all my fiction plays with. But I don't think you could write a first person book and it not be unreliable. I just don't think you'd be doing it properly.
Well, it seems like there's more books like that now, and it's more like a common trait that you find in books. And it seems odd if you read like a few of them in quick succession to then read like a traditional book. And it seems very sort of clunky and old-fashioned, and you can see everything sort of being manoeuvred into place. And it seems really,
I wonder,
strange.
If it's just that we're postmodernists and we don't want a third person omnipresent, but that would be the most unreliable thing of all, wouldn't it?
Unbelievable thing. It seems that it's, in a way, it's kind of, I think it's like how the novel has like evolved in a sense. It's like you have to, previously it was, books were about things and what they were about was the important thing. And now it's like, that is still the case, but the form is like a very important thing and is completely like intertwined with the subject matter.
And my books are coming apart more and more. So the Friday Gospels is not, you couldn't say it was a collection of short stories, but if you kind of had one eye shut and it was dark, then it might be mistaken for one. And I've been writing short stories for the past couple of months, and I think the next, I don't know really what the next thing I'm going to write is going to be, but I'm really interested in composite novels and fragments and how they get put together. And I can't remember the title of it, I'll have to look it up, but a book that it was an auction catalogue, and it was a story of a couple's relationship told by photographs, annotated photographs of all the things that they owned. Yeah, it was fantastic. And I want to do something that's like that. Just this idea of a big slab of paragraphs with bits that go into the past tense to do flashbacks and all these, those kind of, this isn't how it is. That's not how we walk around and experience the world. It just isn't. So I think what I write next will be much more fragmented and less like a novel.
I have like a vague plan in my mind that I've not really worked out somehow to make a short story that's written in Microsoft Excel.
I don't know how it works,
but I think if there's a way that you can use Excel to make a story be told, I think it'd be really interesting. But I've no idea how I'd do it.
I think you'll probably figure it out.
Have you ever read there's a Rick Moody short story that's supposedly like a long advert for a series of CDs that are coming out, and it's CDs that are this guy's favourite songs, and it's like 20 CDs, and it's like listing his personal relationship to each song, and it sort of forms this
like two stories, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's kind of like Pale Fire. I'm not really, but I kind of imagine, like, you get a sense of
something annotated.
I always think that's really interesting. I'd like to write a novel that's like entirely footnotes.
Yeah,
that'd be kind of interesting.
Pale Fire is so good.
Really,
I think you gave me it years and years and years ago. It was your old, and you tried it a few times and didn't get on with it.
Actually, it was when we were at like Runshaw, I think.
Yeah,
and I was like 16.
And I'd had it, I think, for about 10 years, and I tried reading it 4 or 5 times. And didn't, maybe I wasn't old enough or I hadn't read other things, but then I read
it. It's like I was saying about form, it's like not something that really would have occurred to me then.
No, but then I read it just like last August, and I was on a camping holiday, and it was the rainiest week that Wales had ever seen, and I was with two kids in a tent while the rain and slugs howled around us and red pale fire, and I don't think I realised that it was funny. And then as soon as I did, then I could, you know, it all kind of clicked together for me. Like Lolita's funny, and I didn't realise that until the second time I read it.
No, there's quite a lot of books like that. Like a lot of cult classics that you read as a teenager in a very serious way, and you sort of take
really
like
pole faced, weren't
we? Then you look back at them as now that you go, like, this is really kind of either A, crap, why are you even like this, or B, like really funny. And I know, and you know, you don't notice it because you don't really associate literature with like.
But did you read when you were 16 or 17 that you thought was brilliant at the time and now think is a bit crap?
There probably is. I can't actually think of any of this off my head. I'm not quite as enamoured of Catcher in the Rye as I was.
I still
really like it, but there's lots of it that does seem kind of quite clunky.
Mine is On the Road.
Oh yeah, all that sort of beatnik stuff. I'm totally done with now. if I look at any Jack Kerouac, I think like that's not
maybe
writing.
Maybe you've just got to be that age.
Someone said about Jack Kerouac that it's not writing; it's just typing, which is true. It's just
that's what I do. I type.
But yours involves some thought. He just seems to like describe whatever's going on in his life.
What was the one? I used to sit and read it in public quite a lot. I think it was Junkie.
Oh, yeah. To be honest, William Burroughs, I still find interesting.
I don't think I've ever revisited, so I couldn't make a judgment. But
Junkie's kind of interesting because it's like an unreliable narrator, but it's like one of those where it's before unreliable narrators, and he really doesn't mean it to be, I don't think. So he's trying to describe this kind of tough life on the street as a drug guy. But then every now and again he'll accidentally mention like going to have sex with men in toilets and stuff, or like a terrible personal life with his wife, and you kind of think this is
sounds like the singing detective. No,
actually the singing detective is another thing that I think if I watch now I don't think I quite like it.
It's on telly.
Oh, really?
Mm.
I think there's some bits that I remember being not particularly. Some characters are very stock characters, which I think he says like or tries to make out that they're deliberately that way for some kind of clever postmodern reason, but it's still like you might as well write that.
Did you ever read Hide and Seek?
Yeah.
I thought that was just one of the just most splendid books, and I read it around that time. 16,
did you read
17.
That recently?
No, I don't dare because I was just impressed.
The thing
by
about
it.
That was like it was the ideas behind it that was kind of going out. Fiction can be, you can have a book about a writer writing about, you know.
But he makes
character.
It all, I mean, I really resist this idea that narrative is a way of dealing with trauma. I think it's bollocks. But in Hide and Seek, he kind of writes himself into being okay. And terrible things have happened to him and he's alright at the end.
I think that's like
the
Bell Jar, which is like a book that teenagers read all the time. But I've read it quite recently. And I think there's a lot more stuff going on that teenagers would never notice.
No.
And it's a lot more, and that's the same thing. I think it's at the end of it. It's supposed to be like a, you know, this girl who's depressed and she goes through all these kind of strange, not really any plot circumstances. And then at the end, she's kind of made better by this hospital she goes to. But when you read it, it's really clear. It's really clear that she's like not, and there's all these like clues all the way through to suggest that she's not. And it's like she's there with like her. She got like it says it's describing how clean and pretty she looks and she's dressed really well. And it's all things like you can't see the cracks of in the leather because they've been shined on the shoes so well. And it's all like really, really,
just
really
painted
detailed.
Over.
And it really surprised me how it's a really good book. And it's kind of annoying.
Maybe
it's such a teenager.
There's just books that you shouldn't be allowed to read when you're 16 or 17. I read Bell Jar. I think you gave me it. I was about 18, and I thought it was awful.
Really?
But I probably just didn't get it or just missed so much about it, but I didn't like it at all. Just bleating. I'll tell you what. So, you listen to that guy outside Leyland Town Council? You know, if you went to Tesco's, right, every morning, all day, he stands out there and he's got a sign made of polystyrene and it says, a corrupt Tory council. And I don't think they are Tory anymore, or they didn't used to be. A corrupt Tory council, one rule for them, another for the rest of us.
Is he just a protest or is he just mentally ill?
He just stands there all day, every day. I first saw him when I worked at the prison, and that was 2009. 2008, 2009. And I drove the other day and he's still there. And that's dedication.
It is. Or just, you know.
No, he's probably got like a properly a good point.
It's like, it's having a good point though, and there's like if he explained to you like why the council are bad, you'd be like, oh yeah, I suppose they are.
Because he writes to the Leyland Guardian or whatever it is. The reason why is because he lives next door to a councillor who runs a taxi firm from her garage, but she doesn't have to pay a business rates.
See, that's like a grievance. That's fine.
But he's right.
Yeah, but he's also standing outside Tesco with like a polystyrene placard on. It's like, no one's going to listen to your argument if you, except for most people will listen to an argument if you look completely insane.
I just give him a beep and a salute.
Let me tell you when I went to the war protest thing in London. There was this guy, when we were on the coach going from Liverpool to the big anti-war demo that was like, you know, millions of people. And there was a guy on the coach and he like came around handing out flyers. I thought it was like an anti-war flyer, but it was like folded up and it was like a massive A3 sheet of paper that was like a photocopied photograph of him outside his house. And it was like, you could see a bit of the house, but most of it was obscured because he had these massive signs outside that had really specific allegations about some lawyers who live near him and a councillor or something.
I know, that's what's going to happen to me.
Exactly.
No, it is.
But then, like, yeah.
I'm going to start papering my house in tinfoil in the shape of BT CEOs.
I was like, okay, cheers, thanks, and sort of ignored him and, you know, forgot about it. And then about 2 months later, I heard about this guy in Liverpool who'd taken someone hostage in the house. And it was like on the news, it was like going on, you know, here's the house. It's really weird because of all these like massive signs that we can't really show because it's got like, you know,
like libelous things.
Yeah, it's got like phone numbers as well for the people. And like, please phone them up and tell them to fucking shove it and stuff like that. And yeah, and he'd taken someone hostage for like 6 months in this house.
Really? Six months?
6 months. He'd like taken like his like a member of his family or something for like a really, really long time. It was this ongoing siege of like people bringing food in, like, you know, having a weapon or something in the house and not letting
them. 6 months? Between interviews, they make us wait upstairs in a classroom. We're left alone, but we're aware that in a nearby office, we are being discussed. Teachers, her parents and mine, the nurse, social workers, and the pair of us with nothing to do but stare out of the windows at the bedlam occurring at the front of the school and wait. We watch the cars arrive and unload. We lean on the sill, making palm prints in the dust. Emma rests her muscly thighs against the radiator. I pull leaves from a brown spider plant and we both look out of the window and say nothing. We listen. The glass muffles the crying and singing, but we can still see the flowers and feel the atmosphere, which is shrieky and curious and raw. These people who we don't know, who Chloe doesn't know, even turn up at the school in coaches. Every single one of them brings something. If it's not roses and baskets of silk flowers, then it's stuffed bears and huge handmade cards. So many ways of spelling her name. They interview us alone, then together, then alone again. Because we're only 14, we're entitled to breaks. We don't discuss the questions we've been asked. We don't compare stories. I never know what Emma is going to say until she comes out and says it. They're putting the candles out now, she says blandly. She nods towards a kneeling figure across the road from the school. He is pulling something out of a carrier bag, laying it out on the pavement. A bank of tea lights blooms as quick as mushrooms to drip and sputter in the shelter where the school buses pick up. Emma leans forward, putting all her weight on her hands. Her breath makes clouds on the glass. Her school jumper smells like old towels. I stare at the flickering candles and remember the time me and Chloe waited there in the rain on a day we were supposed to be at school. The wind will blow them out, I say. Emma nods and we wait, no one breaking the silence, until Shanks comes back with another pair of police officers. What is it now? I say, but not loud enough for Shanks to hear. The police bring us cans of Coke and put their hands on our shoulders. Smile a lot, just to let us know that we aren't in trouble and we shouldn't be afraid of speaking out, of saying everything we knew about Chloe and her boyfriend. Sometimes they film us as we talk and make our parents sign pieces of paper afterwards to say it's all right, they don't mind. I wonder if the cameras will be out this time and what they'll do with the recording and if we'll end up on the television again. Sometimes there are journalists waiting for us after school. They've promised to make special arrangements. Right then, Shanks says, and I notice he's taking the pack of fags out of his breast pocket and that today he's wearing a proper shirt and not a denim one. They just want another 5 minutes with each of you, one at a time, and then you can go back to classes. He smiles, tries a joke. No getting out of maths today, I'm afraid, girls. Who's first? Emma and I don't look at each other. She steps forward. I see her ponytail bob from side to side against her neck. I don't wonder what she is going to tell them. Shanks takes her away and I turn back to my window. Another coach has arrived.